Morning, everybody. This morning, I'm pleased to have Dr. Warren Brenner from Hematology Oncology to give us a talk today on a very important topic, monoclonal gammopathies. Most of us in private practice see a lot of this, and obviously the biggest issue is which patients do you refer, which patients do you don't, which patients are going to progress, et cetera. Dr. Brenner did his medical school and internship in Johannesburg, South Africa. He subsequently came to the United States and did his fellowship in hematology and oncology at Washington University. He's been with Boca Hospital and the Center for Hematology Oncology since 2006, and he has an interest in hematologic oncology and GI malignancies. It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Brenner.
Okay. Can everyone hear me okay? So I decided to present this topic. Ken asked me initially to do a talk on B12 and folate deficiency, but I thought this was a topic that would suit a lot of people. It's an important topic in internal medicine. It's important for nephrologists. It's important for cardiologists, neurologists, because there's a lot of related disorders that we're going to talk about. So I'm going to explain about some of the testing and how to interpret some of these tests. I think sometimes we order these tests and we don't really know what we're ordering half the time. So I'm going to go through that, and then we're going to talk about some of the common monoclonal gammopathies and the related disorders. So if anyone has any questions, you can also just stop me and we can talk. So I have no relevant financial disclosures, and those are basically the areas that I'm going to cover in this talk. So just going back to medical school days, the immunoglobulins that we're going to talk about, just a little bit about their molecular structure, and I'm really going to talk mainly about IgM, IgG, and IgA, because there are very few hematological disorders that are associated with IgE and IgD antibodies. But just remember that IgM is a big molecule with five antigen-binding sites, and because of its size, it's easy to explain why in something like Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, which is an IgM-related disorder, those are the patients at highest risk for hyperviscosity because of the size of the antibody. IgG is that classic structure that we all remember from medical school days, and then IgA is normally a secretory antibody. So what is a monoclonal protein? So basically it's an immunoglobulin that's secreted by a clonal cell. It may be intact, contain the heavy chain and the light chain. It can be just the light chain, and sometimes and rarely can be just the heavy chain that's excreted. And really, when you see a monoclonal protein, it basically tells you that there's an underlying clonal disorder, either a plasma cell disorder or a lymphoproliferative disorder. And these disorders can be, frankly, malignant, such as multiple myeloma, or they can be a subclinical clone like MGUS, which we're going to talk about. But even with a small clone, you can get important related disorders, which you're also going to talk about. So basically, one of the first tests we start out with is SPEP, which is a serum protein electrophoresis. And this is really meant to be a screening test. And you can see here that this is a normal SPEP, which shows your albumin. Then you have alpha-1, alpha-2, and beta-protein sites. These contain things like haptoglobin, beta-2 microglobulin, ceruloplasmin, and then in the gamma range over here. Now, when you have a monoclonal protein, you'll see a spike often in the gamma range over here, but sometimes they can migrate in the beta side over here as well. So that's what you'll see on a SPEP when you have a monoclonal protein. And we can actually measure this monoclonal protein. So when you see the pathologist read out that the monoclonal protein spike is 0.4 or 1 gram per deciliter, it's based on measurement of this spike over here. So it is a little bit subjective. So it is operator dependent to some extent. We also see polyclonal gammopathy. So this is when you have an elevation in your globulins, but it's all polyclonal. And chronic liver disease is probably the most common cause of a polyclonal gammopathy. So you have elevation of your IgG, IgA, IgM proteins, but it's non-clonal. Also in connective tissue disease, chronic infection, patients who have osteomyelitis may often have a polyclonal gammopathy. There's certain hematological disorders, although that's less common. And then there's a smattering of other causes of polyclonal gammopathy. So when you get an SPAP and you show that there's a monoclonal protein, you need to define what is the monoclonal protein. Is it IgG? Is it IgA? Is it kappa? Is it lambda? And that's where you use serum immunofixation. So this is essential to differentiate between a monoclonal and a polyclonal protein. And you can see here on the slide, you can see that this is staining for an IgG that's kappa-restricted. And a serum immunofixation is more sensitive than a serum. So serum immunofixation is pretty sensitive for detecting a monoclonal protein. You can see I can detect it at a level of as low as 0.02 grams per deciliter, and in urine it can be even more sensitive. And then we've all seen over the last few years the use of serum-free light chains. So just a little bit about the biology. We do excrete normal free light chains that are normally excreted in the urine. It's predominantly kappa, and lambda actually has a longer half-life than kappa, which explains why the normal reference range over here. And this is basically what the free light chain assay detects. So normally when your light chain is linked to your heavy chain at the variable region, this epitope is hidden. But when you excrete free light chains, this epitope is now available to bind on the study. So this is basically what the free light chain antibody is binding to, is this antigen over here. And this is the normal reference range, and you have a normal ratio of kappa to lambda. So just important, I've seen many people order free light chains on the urine, and basically we shouldn't have that test because it's never been validated, and there's really no role for doing free light chains in the urine using this assay. I'll tell you how to do a urine study, but really this is meant to be used just on the serum. And it's important to look at the ratio because in patients with chronic kidney disease, because the light chains are excreted by the kidney, you're going to have elevation of your kappa and lambda free light chains, but you'll notice that in most cases the ratio should be normal. So if there's an abnormal ratio, that could still suggest that there's a clonal process. So basically, serum-free light chains are more sensitive even than serum immunofixation. It's important, and we use it in different settings. We use it in patients who have non-secretory or olisecretory myeloma. It's important in following patients with amyloidosis. It's really the gold standard for how we monitor patients with amyloid because they often have very small M spikes or no M spikes. So we rarely follow them using the free light chain assay. It's also important as a prognostic variable. It's prognostic in MGUS. It's prognostic in smoldering myeloma, solitary plasmacytoma of bone. And it's also important in treatment and monitoring of patients with myeloma. And it's also prognostic in myeloma. So we use it a lot. In patients with MGUS, or even patients with myeloma, we don't have to continually repeat 24-hour urine tests because the serum-free light chains correlate well with free light chains in the urine. So often, you know, once we've done a urine test and it correlates well with the free light chains, we often use free light chains to monitor these patients and not subject them to frequent 24-hour urine tests. So just a little bit about what I explained about with kidney dysfunction, that your free light chains increase as your GFR declines, but you should have a normal ratio. But you can have a ratio up to 3, but if it's greater than 3, kappa to lambda, then it's unlikely to be due to their renal insufficiency alone, and they probably have a clonal process. A very new test that's become available, most hematologists don't even know about it, is the serum heavy light assay. So this is available, but only a select few laboratories do it, I think LabCorp. And basically, you can now measure the IgG and IgG, kappa and lambda, IgG and IgA, kappa and lambda, and you can get a ratio. So you can see, again, if there's a clonal process, and you can actually monitor patients using the heavy light assay. So I use this in patients who have an IgA myeloma because the IgA proteins, when they migrate in the beta region, are sometimes hard to see, and they're kind of inaccurate on the SPEP when you're monitoring them. So you can use the serum heavy light assay in this setting. It's not something that can be ordered from the hospital. So how do we order urine tests in patients with monoclonal gammopathies? So remember, don't order kappa lambda free light chains in the urine, but rather what you have to order is, first of all, a 24-hour urine test. You want to quantify the protein, and then basically you want to do a UPEP, which is analogous to the SPEP, but basically you're checking it in the urine. And then once you detect a spike in the 24 in the UPEP, you can also measure that, multiply that by the amount of protein in the urine, and you'll come up with the amount of Benz-Jones proteins or free light chains excreted in the urine. And then you can, that's how you quantify light chains in the urine. And then also you want to do immunofixation on the urine to make sure that that protein is identified, so you know whether it's an intact protein, whether it's kappa or lambda or IgG or IgA. So these are the M protein disorders that we're going to talk about, because these are probably the most common ones that you'll see in practice by different specialities in internal medicine. And then I'll talk about a new entity as well that has recently been described in the last few years. So this is a case description of a 58-year-old male with no significant medical history, was found to have an elevated total protein just on routine blood work. He's asymptomatic, and he had an SPEP performed based on his elevated total protein, and he was found to have an M spike of 2.1, and immunofixation was done that confirmed that it was an IgG kappa monoclonal protein. So the question is, what further evaluation is warranted? When do you refer these patients, and how should the patient be followed? So MGUS is basically the presence of a monoclonal protein with no evidence of end organ damage. It's the most common plasma cell disorder, and it increases in prevalence with age. So you can see over 5% of the population over the age of 70 will be found to have MGUS. And similar to patients with myeloma, it is high in men and African Americans as well. So we think most patients with myeloma evolve from MGUS. So basically, you have to make sure that there's no evidence of end organ damage. You want to check their CBC, make sure they're not anemic, their kidney function, calcium levels. I don't do 24-hour urines unless they have a M spike greater than 1.5 generally. You do want to determine their free light chains because it's prognostic in MGUS. And basically, we only do bone marrows if the M spikes, you know, I do it if the M spike's greater than 1.5, and the same thing with the skeletal survey, because there's a very low chance that you're going to find any significant abnormalities when the M spike's relatively low. Basically, the same with the bone marrow, we really only reserve it for patients who have higher M protein spikes. And there are some disorders that seem to be related to MGUS. This is predominantly out of the Mayo Clinic, where a lot of the work on monoclonal proteins come from. And there does seem to be an association between MGUS and osteoporosis, hypercalcemia, that's not necessarily due to the clone itself, thrombophlebitis, and even mycobacterium. There's a whole list of them. These are just some of them that I picked that I thought were interesting, but there's a whole list of related disorders that can be associated with MGUS more than you would expect in the general population. So basically, you know, many of these patients are elderly when they diagnose, so, you know, we normally quote patients on average a risk that this will progress to myeloma or lymphoma of about 1% per year. But using different, there are risk models that can help define that risk a little bit better, but on average it's about 1%. But when you take into account competing causes of death, you know, the risk of progressing to myeloma tends to be around 0.5% per year. And these are the risk factors that predict for a higher risk of progression, and these are the patients that I'll follow more closely. It's patients, obviously, with a higher protein level. If we do a bone marrow, patients have higher plasma cell percentages in the bone marrow, if they have an abnormal kappa lambda free light chain, and if it's IgA restricted. So these are patients that I may follow twice a year, even sometimes three times a year, whereas patients with low-risk MGUS could be followed every 12 to 18 months. So smoldering myeloma is kind of the next step in evolution of MGUS, and basically it's defined when the M spike's greater than 3 grams and or they have a bone marrow plasma cell percentage greater than 10%. And again, no evidence of end organ damage. So these patients are at much higher risk of developing myeloma, so we follow them much more closely, and their risk is highest in the first 5 years. So it's 10% per year for the first 5 years, and it decreases to 3% per year, and then back to the same risk as general MGUS. So I follow them roughly every 3 months, at least for the first 2 to 3 years, to make sure the protein's stable, and then may do it twice a year. So these patients do need to be watched more closely. Now, generally, the standard for many years has just been observation, but there was a study published about 2 years ago in the New England Journal, which took patients with smoldering myeloma, but only those with high-risk smoldering myeloma, which is a whole other topic, but it's defined in different ways depending on which country you're in. And basically, the study was out of Spain, and they showed that if they gave patients lenalidomide, which is an immunomodulatory drug similar to thalidomide, that you actually improve survival. So it was a small study, isn't a standard of care, and it's being that same study is being replicated in the U.S. Currently. So myeloma is basically the second most common hematological disorder after lymphoma. There's about 24,000 to 25,000 new cases a year, and the prevalence is increasing because patients are living longer. And basically, there's about 84,000 patients in the U.S. This is going back to 2011. And on average, the five-year survival is about 44%, but that's kind of an old number. And generally, the prognosis depends really on the risk, and we define risk in different ways, which I'll talk about. But the survival can be as low as 2 years for ultra-high-risk myeloma to patients who have a median survival greater than 10 years. And although the classic teaching is that myeloma is not a curable condition, there's probably a group of patients that are long-term survivors greater than 15 years. And it can be as high as 20% if you look at some series. And that just shows, basically, compared to some of the other malignancies we deal with, so it's more common than basically Hodgkin's, acute lymphocytic leukemia, and chronic myeloid leukemia all put together. So it is a common disorder, and it's often, you know, detected by internists initially. So basically, myeloma is defined as having an M protein, and it doesn't have to be a certain number. It can be 0.1, doesn't matter. They have to have more than 10% plasma cells in their bone marrow, and then they have to have evidence of end organ damage, which classically has been defined by the CRAB criteria, which is hypercalcemia, renal dysfunction, anemia, and bone lesions. But now we also have more sensitive tests for detecting bone damage, which we'll talk about as well. And like I spoke about earlier, is we think nearly all cases of myeloma do evolve from MGUS. They may or may not go through the smoldering myeloma phase to classic myeloma, and often you'll see with end-stage myeloma, patients develop extramedullary disease. So they'll develop plasmacytomas in liver. I've seen it in the uterus, CNS involvement, and that's usually an end-stage process. I've already spoken about this, so I'm going to skip this slide. And these are the most common ways that patients with myeloma will present. So we spoke about that patients have to, by definition, have more than 10% plasma cells. They have to have an M protein. And the most common presentation is anemia, and then lytic bone lesions. And then renal insufficiency and hypercalcemia is actually less common, probably about 15% of patients. So a little bit about the bone disease. It's often one of the ways patients are detected by the internist. They may complain of bone pain that's concerning. They may have bone pain at rest. It's different from their general back pain that they may have had for, you know, 15 years. Suddenly it's much more severe and isn't relieved by over-the-counter medication. So those are sometimes warning signs. And basically it's due to this process of increased osteoclast formation, decreased osteoblasts. So because they decrease osteoblasts, this is why we don't do bone scans in myeloma, because it's not a sclerotic process, and often you'll get a normal bone scan. So don't order bone scans in patients with myeloma. Basically, we do skeletal surveys, but understanding that you have to destroy close to 70% of your trabecular bone to see it on a plain X-ray. So now we're using more sensitive tests. At Boca, we're using a whole body MRI. So it's basically one sequence, but you do an MRI of basically your spine, pelvis, long bones, and you're able to sequence, you're able to look at all the bones with an MRI. A lot of centers use whole body low dose CT. We don't have that available, but that's another way. And there is an evolving role for PET scanning as well to look for bone disease, understanding that for to be detect on PET scan, lesions have to be, you know, probably about 10 millimeters or bigger. But MRI can detect lesions as small as 5 millimeters. So if patients have clearly abnormal skeletal survey, we don't have to perform those other tests unless we're worried about something like spinal cord compression. But in patients who have other features suggestive of myeloma with a normal skeletal survey, then I would normally do a MRI survey or PET CT. Renal disease is another way that patients may present. It's really one of the few medical emergencies because our drugs are much better. We're now able to salvage many of these patients and prevent them from needing full-term dialysis. It's really something that we'll treat patients emergently for. And basically, it's due to protein deposition from monoclonal light chains, and there's some other rare causes. Patients may also have amyloid Fanconi syndrome, so they present with glucose in the urine and a normal serum glucose, low phosphorus, and things that show tubular wasting. Those are things that suggest Fanconi syndrome, but it's a rare presentation. And these are the things that predict for reversibility of their renal dysfunction. So if their creatinine is less than 4, if they're hypercalcemic, because that's something that's often reversible, and if their protein excretion is less than a gram in 24 hours. But basically, if I suspect myeloma and patients got significant renal dysfunction, I'll treat them immediately and kind of do all the confirmatory tests later, because it's really the sooner you can start treating them, the more chance you have of reversing their renal dysfunction. And basically, the drugs that we have now basically have response rates of close to 100%. So we know that with effective therapy, nearly everyone's going to respond to treatment. So we spoke a little bit about the prognosis. So basically, we use what's called the ISS staging system, which is based on two simple parameters, albumin and beta-2 microglobulin. So basically, the higher the beta-2 microglobulin, the higher the stage. Greater than 5.5 is stage 3. It's stage 1, 2, and 3. And it's also based on serum albumin. Cytogenetics is probably the most important. So there's certain cytogenetics that we consider high risk, the most important being a 17p deletion. And just that you know, in myeloma, most times the metaphase cytogenetics is normal because the cells are not proliferating very rapidly, so we rely on a FISH panel, interface FISH, to detect many of the cytogenetic abnormalities in myeloma. And there's been dramatic drug development over the last 10 to 12 years. We have different classes of drugs, and we're using less and less chemotherapy. We use the IMiDs, such as thalidomide, lenalidomide, and pomalidomide. They become more potent. Thalidomide, you know, we were using 200 to 400 milligrams. Lenalidomide is 25 milligrams, and pomalidomide is 4 milligrams. So these drugs are becoming more potent and less toxic. Then we have what's called the proteasome inhibitors, which basically inhibit the proteasome, which leads to protein buildup in the cell, and it's toxic to the cell. We have bortezomib, which is Velcade. We have colfizumab, which is Kyprolis, and ixazomib is the new oral one that's probably going to become available in the next year. We also have novel antibodies. We all know about Rituxan, which is a monoclonal antibody, and now we have antibodies against CSS1 and CD38, and in fact, the drug was just approved yesterday, which targets CD38 called daratumumab. So that's a very exciting agent in myeloma with very little toxicity. We're using a lot less chemotherapy than we used to, and steroids is still an important backbone of treatment for myeloma. Waldenstrom's macular globulinemia is one of the other disorders that you'll often see in practice. It's basically it's a lymphoproliferative disorder, almost always associated with an IgM protein, very rarely IgG or IgA. And there's a new test that's become available called a MID88, which we do have available here. And basically, it's positive in more than 90% of patients who have Waldenstrom's. So sometimes a pathologist cannot differentiate, let's say, based on a bone marrow, whether a patient had Waldenstrom's or a marginal zone lymphoma, and then we can use this MYD88 to differentiate between the two because it's almost always positive in patients with Waldenstrom's. And basically, patients can present in numerous ways related to the IgM protein. They can develop organ dysfunction, most commonly anemia. They can present with hyperviscosity, which doesn't always correlate with the viscosity level. So although you measure the viscosity level, sometimes patients can have hyperviscosity symptoms and actually have normal viscosity. So it's really clinical judgment. They can present with cryoglobulinemia. They can present with cold agglutinins. And the first new drug, actually the only drug that's formally approved by the FDA for Waldenstrom's is ibrutinib, which is Imbruvica, which targets a protein called BTK. And it's approved in leukemia, it's approved in different lymphomas, and it's also improved in Waldenstrom's, and it's an excellent drug that we use that's very well tolerated. Amyloid is also another important condition to be recognized by internists and multiple specialists. This is actually also a case that I had when I was a fellow. It was a 53-year-old female who presented with fatigue and weight loss, and on her lab work was found to have extremely high alkaline phosphatase and normal AST and ALT, and was found to have hepatomegaly. Also very high gamma GT, but relatively normal bilirubin. And they were found to have proteinuria, typical for patients with amyloid. There was no monoclonal protein detected on SPEP. Even the serum immunofixation was negative. And when I saw her, we didn't have the free light chain assay, but they did have a lambda light chain in the urine. So remember, 75% of patients with amyloid, the protein is going to be lambda restricted. So lambda is much more common than kappa restriction. And often these patients will have only a small amount of plasma cells in their bone marrow. They do not have extensive bone marrow involvement unless they have myeloma and amyloid. And basically this patient ended up having a liver biopsy that confirmed amyloid. So it's an uncommon disorder. And amyloid is basically a protein that changes conformation, aggregates, and forms these fibrils that damage organs, most commonly the heart and kidney. but it can affect numerous other organs, but kidney most commonly, heart, can also affect the liver. Anywhere in the GI tract, I've had patients present with diarrhea as a manifestation of amyloid. Rheumatological features, such as carpal tunnel, they can present with. We all know the classic teaching of macroglossia, periorbital bruising. A little bit about the cardiac issues. So this is really, patients have extensive cardiac disease. This is the most poor prognostic feature. They often may present with right-sided congestive heart failure. Classically, they have low-voltage EKG. They may have a pattern that looks like an MI in the absence of coronary artery disease. And on echocardiogram, they have a thickened ventricle and classically has this sparkling appearance on echo, and also classically has worsening of features when patients are treated with calcium channel blockers. Patients can also present with nephrotic syndrome. It's an important cause and an important differential diagnosis when you see a patient with nephrotic syndrome. Patients have been found to have inferior survival if they have lambda-restricted Benz-Jones proteins, regardless of the level of the serum creatinine. So again, we spoke about some of the GI effects of amyloid. They can present with significant hepatomegaly, but that classic picture of a very high ALP-FOS and a gamma GT and relatively normal liver enzymes. Jaundice is a poor prognostic feature. Patients can also present with splenomegaly and develop features of functional hypersplenism. But like I said, it could be found anywhere in the gastrointestinal system. Patients can also present with neuropathy. It's often progresses fairly rapidly, usually distal and symmetrical first, and then progresses more proximately. Cranial nerve and autonomic involvement is less common, but I have seen it, and motor neuropathy is rare. And these are some of the other classic features of amyloid, the macroglossia, shoulder infiltration, which is amyloid-associated arthropathy, and then the periorbital bruising. And basically, you look for factor 10 deficiencies. So most patients who have factor 10 deficiency, two-thirds of them where it's acquired, will have systemic amyloid. So if you someone presents with an elevated PTT and bruising, and they're found to have a factor 10 deficiency, you have to evaluate them for amyloid. So basically, it's a serious disease. It has a high mortality. And the survival generally has been poor, but it is improving because the drugs we use to treat amyloid are the same drugs we use to treat myeloma. So the drugs are better, so patients are doing better. But survival is really dependent on the organ system. So patients who have cardiac involvement still do poorly, especially if they present with heart failure, whereas patients who have kidney involvement can do well for many, many years. This is a list of some of the disorders. It's not doesn't include all of them, but some of the more common ones. These are disorders that are associated with small clones of monoclonal protein. Of monoclonal cells. We spoke about amyloid, light chain deposition disease, which is mostly kappa restricted, greater than 90%, as opposed to amyloid, which is lambda restricted. POEM syndrome, which stands for polyneuropathy, organomegaly. They can have an endocrinopathy, anything thyroid, adrenal. They develop skin changes and also metabolic disturbance. And these patients are almost always IgG lambda, and they classically have an elevated VEGF level. So you can actually measure VEGF levels, and it's helpful in the diagnosis. We spoke about acquired Fanconi syndrome, cryoglobulinemia, and then there's some more rare disorders that are associated with monoclonal plasma cells. So this is one thing that I did want to talk to everyone about because it's actually only newly described. I think a lot of nephrologists don't even know about it. It's called monoclonal gammopathy of renal significance as opposed to monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. So basically, this was described also out of the Mayo Clinic. And it's when patients have renal conditions that are associated with a plasma cell disorder that's more MGUS-like. So they have these patients have these small M proteins, low plasma cell involvement, but they present with kidney dysfunction. And we're really finding more and more of these patients when we're more aggressive with getting kidney biopsies. And if someone has a creatinine of 2, they have a small M protein, they're 75, you don't know if it's related. And the only way you really find out is if you do kidney biopsies and you see if there's basically kidney involvement by the monoclonal protein that's found in the serum and that correlates with what's found in the kidney. And these are some of the pathological kidney diseases that patients present with. They can present with cryoglobulinemia, immunotactoid glomerulonephropathy. They can present with what's called monoclonal immunoglobulin deposition of the Randall type. They can even present with the proliferative glomerulonephritis. And basically, we treat these patients with drugs to treat the monoclonal disorder. So often with drugs like Rituxan or Cytoxan. And often if we're able to treat the underlying monoclonal disorder, kidney function will at least stabilize or improve. That's it. Any questions? So remember, by definition, MGUS is an asymptomatic condition. So it's not recommended as a general screening test as part of, you know, yearly physical exams, but it should be ordered if patients have elevated total protein. So often I have patients refer to me for MGUS or myeloma, and I look back at their labs over the last 2 years, and you can see their total protein has been slowly going up. And initially, maybe even within the normal range, but it was 6.5, 7.1, 7.8. I think those kind of things you should pay attention to, because even if it's in a normal range, but the total protein's been creeping up over the last year or two, I would consider ordering an SPEP. Obviously, if the total protein's elevated outside the normal range, you should order SPEP. But again, it's not recommended as part of just a yearly screening test because it's still, you know, 5% of the population, and most patients are not going to develop, you know, myeloma. And then obviously we spoke about some of the other disorders that patients may present with that are associated with a small MGUS clone. So if you see a patient and they've developed new onset neuropathy symptoms, and you may not have other explanations for neuropathy, they're not diabetic, then I would start with a screening test such as an SPEP or serum immunofixation. So that's often how we get patients referred to us, either from a lot from nephrologists and a lot from neurologists. Because patients present with neuropathy, they may present with some mild kidney dysfunction. So that's when you're considering ordering SPEPs in patients who present with some renal dysfunction, neuropathy symptoms. And you've got to think about amyloid. You know, if you don't think about amyloid, you're going to miss the diagnosis. So again, patients who present with new onset congestive heart failure, they've got a thickened ventricle, because sometimes the findings are subtle. So those are the things we've got to think about when you order these tests, but not recommended as a screening. Yeah, no, so the answer to that is basically the recommendation is that if the M protein's less than 1.5, you could probably hold off on doing a bone marrow because the chance of those patients having smoldering myeloma is relatively low. So my cutoff on average is 1.5, but you know, if someone's 46 and they have an M protein of 1.1, you know, I'm going to do a bone marrow on those patients. But if someone's 82 or 86 or 75 and they have a small M protein, we're not doing bone marrows on those patients as routine because the vast majority of them are never going to evolve into myeloma. In patients who have smoldering myeloma, we watch them more closely but don't necessarily repeat their bone marrows unless they're becoming anemic and, you know, maybe they have a little bit of kidney dysfunction that's long-standing. We don't know if the anemia is due to their kidneys or not, so sometimes we'll repeat the bone marrow to see if they have increasing plasma cells in their bone marrow. But remember that it could be patchy. You know, you could be in one area and have 18% and go, you know, 2 centimeters to the left and have 35%. So you've got to use kind of clinical judgment to interpret those tests and because there is some fluctuation in how the plasma cells are read and also the way pathologists interpret these tests because the percentage is quantified by immunohistochemical staining. So, you know, again, that's not a perfect technology.